I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, I have a conversation with Martha S. Jones about birthright citizenship.
Isn't that nice?
Before the current administration took office, most people probably didn't spend much time debating or thinking about birthright citizenship. And even if you have thought about it, you've probably only thought about it in the context of modern immigration. For instance, what's happening right now at the border, or in the context of asylum seekers. But have you ever stopped to think about how the idea of birthright citizenship became law? When and how were Americans, and which Americans specifically, were granted citizenship based on the mere fact that they were born on American soil? Now, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution was adopted in 1868, of course, and this grants the right to all persons born or naturalized in the U.S. citizenship. But how did we get there as a nation? Well, today's guest, Professor Martha S. Jones, has thought a lot about this question. Martha S. Jones wrote the book Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. And that book details how African-American activists, formerly enslaved people, fought for the right of citizenship. There was this long period of ambiguity and chaos around the idea of what constitutes a citizen. There were a lot of solutions on the table, including various efforts to remove formerly enslaved people from America. But you know what? They weren't going to have it. Black activists fought for birthright citizenship, and in doing so, they radically transformed the terms of citizenship for all Americans. It's really fascinating, and it's a sad history. You know, Trump recently hinted at changing the language granting birthright citizenship using an executive action. So we're not out of the woods. Anyhow, without further ado, here's my conversation with Martha S. Jones. You know, so when we think about birthright citizenship, I think in this country today, when I hear it, I don't think that most people think about it in this broader historical context that you talk about in the book, right? And we talk about it in the context of immigration debates, you know, and it struck me that, you know, when we celebrate the diversity of this country, you know, this whole idea of it being a melting pot, you know, without acknowledging that Black Americans and formerly enslaved people fought for the right, you know, that paved the way for others. It's something that we don't acknowledge very often.
Birthright citizenship is this, or has for many Americans been this quiet, almost unspoken, but really powerful way of organizing who belongs and who doesn't belong in this country. I'm born in New York City. And I venture to say my parents, my father, who was descended from former slaves, probably himself didn't give a lot of thought to the birthright dimension of my citizenship, even as he might have thought about many other dimensions of it.
Right. And I agree. I mean, I grew up in the South, and I'm certain that, you know, most of the generations before me were probably generations of former slaves. And I think it deserves more acknowledgement. I mean, do you think that it's important to understanding the debate on birthright citizenship that we're having today?
I do, because birthright citizenship today is oftentimes shrouded in a combination of myth and misunderstanding. It's often spoken of as an error or an excess or some obscure artifact of the past. And when I hear that, it seems important to say to people, well, in fact, birthright citizenship is an extension of an extraordinary sea change moment in our country when we move significantly toward more perfect union, right, to a democracy. And that is by incorporating former slaves and their descendants into the body politic. That's no afterthought or excess. That is Congress and the nation as a whole manifesting a deep, profound vision of what democracy is. We have to start there before we enter into what are certainly debates of our own time about the future of birthright.
Yeah. You know, when I was reading your book, the most fascinating part to me was reading about that kind of uncertain time where, you know, in parts of the country, people were still enslaved, and then other parts of the country, people weren't. You know, that time, you know, sometime before the Civil War, before the Emancipation Proclamation, where, you know, things weren't certain, right? You know, and I think what's interesting is that formerly enslaved people or Black people generally, as they moved around the country, you know, their status and their legal status was just uncertain. It was kind of ambiguous. I mean, was there a specific legal status that they had? Because they weren't citizens and they also weren't immigrants. What was their legal status, the formal legal status?
Part of what I'm trying to capture in Birthright Citizens is, in a sense, the emergence of this alternative status, neither slave nor free. Sometimes people who are termed the free Negro or free people of color are in a sense becoming their own distinct category in the United States with an awkward place before the Constitution. And that is a story that we overlook when we regard the pre-Civil War era as one simply about the problem of race or racism and slavery. There is also a problem of racism and freedom. And these former slaves are the people who really, first and foremost in our history, need to push on, to insist on, to foreground the question of national belonging in a way that no community had done before them.
Yeah. And you know, that unique distinction, it's almost lost now, right? The assumption is, I think, and it's not a correct assumption, is that, you know, Black Americans and white Americans are have the same experience to this point. And people acknowledge that that isn't true, but the distinction of citizenship, you know, isn't made very often.
And it's, of course, it's not an academic question for former slaves, though they're certainly interested in the intellectual threads, right, that weave together to give us a concept like birthright citizenship. It's not an academic question in that these are people who are facing the threat of removal from the country. They are facing kind of organized and formidable forces that see the United States as a white man's country, who forces that anticipate the end of slavery, but do not anticipate an interracial democracy. So here you have people coming to an old and powerful concept, but using it for the express purpose of resisting the movement that we call colonization, which is a movement which in essence that is aimed at removing former slaves from the country altogether.
Yeah, but you know, when you think about it, it's really interesting to go from this position of, you know, within a short span of time to being seen as not fully human, right? To then say that not only are we fully human, but we also deserve the status of citizenship in a country that, you know, still most people did not recognize them, you know, even though legally that, you know, once slavery ended, didn't recognize them as being fully human or deserving of full human rights, you know, but to then say that, you know, not only that, but we also deserve equal status as citizens. I thought that was a really bold gesture and move to make.
It is. And there are a lot of things that are underneath that claim. One of them is a close reading of the Constitution. We can talk more about that. But these are also people who are foregrounding military service, right? In the communities of free African Americans are men who had served both during the American Revolution and during the War of 1812. And so they ask out loud, shouldn't military service entitle us to membership in the body politic? These are people who argue that they have labored and contributed to the nation's growth and prosperity, many of them unrequited labor for important parts of their lives. And they ask, right, shouldn't we, as people who have contributed in an economic sense to the nation, also enjoy citizenship? These are important principles that undergird the claim to citizenship, but ultimately they are going to become very astute students of the Constitution itself and recognize, first and foremost, that there is this notion in the Constitution of a natural born citizen. The president has to be a natural born citizen of the United States, and that there's no color line in the Constitution of 1787, at least not an express color line. And they are going to pull all of this together to really set on the table for the country, what does it mean to be an American and what must one do in order to inhabit that status?
Right. I thought that was really interesting. So what happened was, in the context of the Constitution, it was used to in legal arguments to say that there is no mention of race, there is no mention of color in the Constitution. They use it as, in a way, a loophole. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the strains that I noted throughout the book was that, you know, the amount of legal literacy that one needed to be able to navigate these debates was amazing, right? And, you know, I felt like everyone had to kind of be, you know, an armchair legal scholar just mm-hmm. to kind of secure their own citizenship and sometimes to even, you know, purchase their spouse or their children. But can you talk a bit about this whole thing about the Constitution and using that as an argument for a citizenship?
Sure. And you really put your finger on, you know, one of the contributions of the book, which is that former slaves, even as they are deemed in many ways to be marginal to legal culture, they can't be judges or lawyers, they can't formally study law, they can't hold office, they do find ways through which to teach themselves what they need to know about the law, what they need to understand about the Constitution, whether it's through their newspapers or in political conventions or through the hiring of lawyers. Sometimes very highly placed legal minds become their allies, if you will, in their effort to secure, you know, what you characterize as legal literacy. And that it turns out that the interpretation of the Constitution is not only a project of the legal elite, that in the early history of this country, many Americans are reading the text, debating its terms, bringing pressure on officialdom to see the Constitution their way. Not wholly surprising, still there are moments in which I see former slaves, you know, very deliberately approaching a former United States Attorney General to ask his opinion about their status, approaching the president of a colonization society to get an opinion about their status. These are not casual or unsophisticated reflections. These are people who I think are in some ways the precursors to our 20th century NAACP Legal Defense Fund in Thurgood Marshall. But these are people who understand law to be a powerful tool in their struggles for equality. And the question is, how are they going to get that? And that's part of the story I'm able to recover in the book.
Yeah, that's very, very different to our relationship to law today. And I mean, it's seen as kind of this, you know, elite kind of removed set of knowledge that only a certain people have. And I think that that hurts people in the debates today in that, for instance, you know, we have these debates over whether seeking asylum is legal. And of course it is, right? But the average person doesn't know that and doesn't have the knowledge to be able to advocate for themselves in the way that slaves were advocating for themselves. I'm not really sure what changed, right? I don't know what changed.
Well, a lot changed. but one of the things to say, you know, is that you're not wrong that legal knowledge becomes increasingly associated with specialized training, with a kind of elite realm of kind of thought and access. And certainly the interpretation of the Constitution over time necessarily becomes far more complex and linked to a long history. So to try and interpret the Constitution in, say, 1820, while not a straightforward matter, is less burdened, if you will, by what comes before than certainly in the 21st century. I think the other thing that's changed is, of course, that today we associate an important part of the struggles over the meaning of citizenship and civil rights. That has become the purview of cause lawyering organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union or the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Well, in the early 19th century, organizations like this don't exist. And so former slaves in Baltimore, which is the story I write, create something called the Legal Rights Association. And through that, they conduct research, they make consultations. So you're right to say that in some sense, these questions are closer to the ground and in the hands of ordinary people. But at the same time, I would say today, to the degree that I and many other people have been trying to talk through these questions in 21st century terms, there's no question that podcasts and radio and television and newspapers are places that we go hoping that our ideas, our research, our insights will reach people who are on the front lines of these questions and being affected. So that's partly, incumbent on us as researchers, as experts, to choose wisely the kind of places that we spend time, the kind of places that we, where we give interviews, because we also have the ability to make sure that the things we know are available to people who are being affected if we care to do that. And so thank you, for the chance to be here, because it's a good example of the kind of vehicle that can make it to many more people than, say, even the book itself.
So speaking again of the Constitution, and this is more of a comment than a question, the exclusion of race, I felt when I was reading this, was more of an oversight and not intentional, which I think is fascinating. I mean, do you agree?
Well, I certainly agree, at least to the extent that by 1790, right, the newly constituted Congress is going to pass the first Naturalization Act, National Naturalization Act, and is going to limit naturalization to persons, so-called white persons. Well, there's a sign, right, of at least one important strain of thought in Congress about race and rights. But at the same time, lots of the rights that we associate with citizenship today are being arbitrated not by Congress, but by state legislatures. And in the state I write about, Maryland, when Maryland regulates voting rights early on, it draws no color line. And African American men vote in the state of Maryland up until the early years of the 19th century. So it's to say, even as certainly racism is present and informing and a part of the fabric of legal culture and political culture from the inception of this nation and prior to it, it is useful and important, I think, to demonstrate that not only are there cracks in that system, but that it is into those cracks that former slaves insert themselves or attempt to insert themselves to really transform the centrality of racism to the nation. They don't always succeed, but they recognize that they have an opportunity in this close reading of the language of the Constitution to build allies to their cause. And indeed they do. There are people in officialdom who read that Constitution and say, wow, it's in fact the case that there is no color line. And that will be the argument that by the time we get to the Civil War era, will not only catch on, it'll be the argument that carries the day.
So I want to talk about William Yeats for a moment. And I know you mentioned two William Yeats in the book, and it's kind of a mystery which you unveil, I think, at the end of chapter one. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk about the William Yeats, the one that I think was an abolitionist, right? A white abolitionist. And he wrote a treatise in 1938 titled The Rights of Colored Men. Is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah. And so, first of all, who was this William Yeats and why was he compelled to write this treatise and what was in this treatise?
So Yeats is, as you said, an abolitionist, a sort of wannabe journalist turned abolitionist from upstate New York. He is remarkable among abolitionists because he's very clear that the slaves' cause is paramount, but that the interests of free people of color are fused with the interests of slaves. They are one and the same to Yeats. And so he spends his time working among and with former slaves, principally in the North and to some degree in the South in the border state of Delaware. And Yeats is an advocate for the civil rights and the political rights of former slaves. He winds up writing a treatise, and boy, we really appreciate him for doing this, not only for the past, but for historians, because it's a wonderful artifact. Yeats's view is that at the founding, the nation was colorblind. Now, we could quibble with that. I'm not sure that Yeats was correct. But as an advocate, he says, the founding of the nation was colorblind. Have a look. he says, at the Constitution. And he ascribes the degree to which racism has been written into American law as an error that needs to be corrected. And he wants to correct it by publishing and circulating this treatise called Rights of Colored Men, where he chronicles and draws together and crafts a story about how it is, in fact, that former slaves are citizens of the United States. There is close reading of the Constitution itself. There is look at debates in Congress. There is a look at court decisions. There is look at the rhetoric of presidents and political leaders. And Yeats pulls together a powerful and enduring artifact, which is a legal treatise that is the culmination, if you will, or the summation of the arguments that had been made in lots of varied places. He sort of pulls it all together in 1838 to give former slaves a tool, an instrument of advocacy in the form of a text.
You know, what I think is really interesting about the treatise is that, and I think you say this in the book, that his position or his argument was rather naive, but his assertion was that the lack of rights for, you know, former slaves and for Black people during that time, the lack of rights and, you know, not being granted citizenship was a function of, it was a function of amnesia. I think that's the word that's used.
The word amnesia, yeah.
Yeah, amnesia and not fully understanding their contribution and not because of anti-Blackness or the underlying reasons we understand for racism today. Is that correct? Like, what was his background that gave him that view of America?
Well, I'm of two minds about this question, right? On the one hand, Yeats is not alone. And until today, we can find legal commentators who would argue that at the founding, the framers render the Constitution colorblind and that this should be the principle or the ideal that guides constitutional interpretation, even until this day. That argument exists. It is an argument that I think Yeats would make even if he didn't believe it to be true, which is to say he's an abolitionist. He's part of a community that is strongly debating the Constitution itself. William Lloyd Garrison, right? That probably the best remembered of the white abolitionists of this era and among the most radical. Well, Garrison said the Constitution was, right, a compact with slaveholders, and that abolitionists should do no business with law or politics of the Constitution because it was a corrupt document. Frederick Douglass will initially subscribe to Garrison's view and then break away and say, no, actually the Constitution is anti-slavery. So it is to say for abolitionists, the Constitution is an important touchstone, but part of what abolitionists are doing, of course, is advocacy. They are making politics. They are looking to persuade. And in this sense, Yeats is not alone. So he wants to appeal to white Americans in particular. He wants to give them a foundation from which in the 1830s and the 1840s to argue against slavery and against racism. And he thinks that if he offers them a history that is the founder's history, that is anti-racist, I use that term carefully, it's not because he's reporting the facts. It's because he's trying to offer people a story about the nation that they can embrace, see themselves through, and use to join the anti-slavery cause. That's what Yeats is really doing. You know, some days we would call that it's propaganda, it's politics. But he recognizes that Americans need a story about the Constitution, in part, to fully embrace the anti-slavery and civil rights causes of their time. And he thinks that if he tells you the founders were racially egalitarians, you might be more inclined to come on board in 1838 and link arms with former slaves.
You know, I see. So he was trying not to antagonize people who could possibly be allies in his fight.
I think more than not antagonize them, I think he's trying to win them over.
Right.
Trying to win them over. And to win them over, you have to tell them a story. And you could say, you could tell a story as Garrison does, which is to say, you need to join this movement because you want to break with the racism of the founders. And Yeats takes another tack and says, no, you want to join this movement because you want to be one and the same with the founders. And both of those men are interested in history and facts. And both of those men are interested in persuading the unconverted to their cause and are aiming to use history as a tool or an instrument in a way that might not satisfy me as a historian.
You know, this sounds really similar to what politicians often do. You know, they'll mask the full story and deliver a narrative, you know, with the goal of persuading people. I mean, that's all politics is, right? And it sounds like he's doing this, you know, in order to win people over, that he needed, you know, he needed to make them feel better about themselves and better about the country's history with slavery and racism.
But it's important, right, in my analysis, to try and hold apart just a little bit the difference between legal analysis and political rhetoric. Now, they exist in the same world. They come out of the same mouths in the same speech, right, and in the same essay. But the story that Yeats tells is not a strictly legal analysis, right? He is selectively choosing episodes that he thinks as a whole will be persuasive. He's crafting a story about the nation that he thinks will be persuasive. Is he completely correct? Perhaps not, but that's not really the point for Yeats, which is to say he is one voice expressing the profound urgency that is felt first and foremost by former slaves and by free African Americans around the abolition of slavery and the realization of citizenship. And for that, right, Yeats appeals to our better selves. He appeals to the better self of the nation. And in order to do that, there are many facts that are left on the cutting room floor.
Yeah. I think a book could be written on this in itself about America and Americans' need to have this poetic narrative about America fed to them and to see, you know, themselves in a better light. Right? That seems to be a constant narrative with this country, to see ourselves in a better light than possibly, you know, we actually are.
Yeah, I think so. And there's no question that, when former slaves now are confronting the question of citizenship, right, they reach back not only to the Constitution, but to the Declaration. And their argument is that the Declaration and its deep engagement with universal ideals of the Enlightenment is one embodiment of the best. And they challenge people, right, to live up to the Declaration. And that requires, if you will, less of an emphasis, less of an indictment of the signers of the Declaration, right, whose lives, whose practices, whose beliefs are shot through with contradictions, right, including slavery and racism. They leave that to the side because they are trying to craft a story that makes the citizenship of African Americans inevitable and necessary to the nation rather than a question or a sidebar or an impossibility.
So I want to talk a bit about colonization, which, you know, there was an American Colonization Society, which I think was founded in, you know, some 30 years before the 14th Amendment, I think in 1817 or 1816. What was that society for and what was their aim?
Colonization has an intellectual history that goes back to the revolutionary era. It takes institutional form, as you said, in the 18 teens with the founding of the American Colonization Society. Colonizationists are anti-slavery, at least to the degree that they acknowledge, admit, anticipate that slavery will end. They're not radical abolitionists. They think the end of slavery could take years or decades or even a century. But they do anticipate that slavery will end as an institution, and some of them will call for it. The question for colonizationists is, what does the nation look like after slavery? And the answer for them, in a nutshell, is that the U.S. must go forward as a white man's country. That means there is no place for former slaves in the country and as part of the body politic in a colonizationist vision. What to do? Colonizationists organize, raise funds, found the colony of Liberia in West Africa, and devote their ideas and their resources, sometimes with public help. They devote themselves to facilitating the removal of former slaves from the country.
But were there ever efforts to, you know, forcibly remove them? Or was it primarily through persuasion? You know, and then also, how do you persuade someone to leave the country that they were born in?
Mostly colonization is moved by way of persuasion or gentle coercion. But there are radical colonizationists who, if they had had their way, would have legislated the forced wholesale removal of former slaves for the country. This is important in my story because it helps us to understand why former slaves take up citizenship. They do so because they think it might protect them from the threat that colonization poses. They are mindful, for example, of the experience of Native Americans and Indian removal and the Trail of Tears. And they think that might be their fate. And as a consequence, citizenship takes on an urgency because they think that if they can establish that they are citizens, they then can resist the pressure of colonization. And it is real pressure in their day-to-day lives.
Right, because it was being delivered to them and it was paternalistic that, you know, this is better for you, right? Post-slavery, this will be a better life for you. You'll have freedom. And, you know, this is a great move. But former slaves and Black people at the time were trepidatious, right? You know, they wanted to continue to reap any benefits from the investments that they'd already made in the country. And just frankly, they just had no ties to Africa and Liberia where they were trying to move them to.
Yeah, Martin Delaney in 1852 writes so eloquently on this, right? He says, you know, the U.S. is not only where we were born, it's where we were raised, it's where we went to school, it's where our parents are buried. You know, this is our place. And so we are hard pressed to consider an alternative like Liberia as a substitute. Now, Delaney's a good example because by 1852, Delaney, and he is not alone, Delaney begins to doubt, even as he believes himself a citizen of the United States, he begins to doubt whether officialdom in the United States will ever recognize that. And so you do have African Americans who, some 5,000 of them, who will migrate to West Africa over the course of decades. It's not a lot of people, but it's an important number. You have others like Delaney who will, if you will, self-deport, emigrationists, we call them, to Canada, to the Caribbean, away from the United States, having given up hope on the aspiration that they should be citizens of the U.S. They will migrate to places that promise them that they can be citizens. And so we get a sharp insight into what's driving this debate and the decision-making of Black Americans. Liberia will offer them citizenship. Trinidad will offer them citizenship. Haiti will offer them citizenship. And that is a powerful draw for people who understand the value of citizenship and are doubtful about whether or not the U.S. can ever actually acknowledge them as that.
Right. I think ultimately, even with the colonization movement and people who decided to immigrate themselves, I think there were fewer than, 20,000 or, 30,000 people, which is a really small percentage given the number of Black Americans who were in the country at the time. Does that number sound about right?
I'm not even sure it's that high, but and there are many estimates, particularly we don't know as well the numbers of people who, if you will, self-deport. Those are much harder to put our finger on. But even the small numbers tell a bigger story, which is about the sorts of pressures, I call it a kind of terror, that those who remain live under. That even people who resist, the lure or the force of colonization, live their day-to-day lives with the threat of colonization always present. And so, like many kind of historical phenomena, numbers tell part of the story, but I think the bigger story is in what it means to be a person who doesn't succumb, if you will, to colonization, but lives, as my folks do, in a state like Maryland, where periodically, the state legislature will once again debate the prospect of forcibly deporting them. And that is a very difficult way to live as an individual, but as a family or as a community, because one can't be certain about what the future holds.
But were there any other threats of forced removal outside of this colonization movement? I mean, because they were trying to persuade rather than to force, I know, this colonization society. Were there any other movements aside from that?
Well, As I said, there is, in a state like Maryland, there are a smaller cadre of people I call radical colonizationists who from time to time are in the state legislature, and they are not interested in persuasion or even gentle coercion. They would, if you will, mirror the Trail of Tears and just forcibly round up African Americans and remove them. It sounds far-fetched, except if you have been, if you will, a witness to Indian removal in the 1830s. So there is that. The other form that the threat takes is what we call black laws. And so these are mostly laws generated by state legislatures that regulate the everyday lives of former slaves. Can people travel? Can they worship? Can they gather in public meetings? Can they own staple crops or guns or dogs? Do they have control over their family lives, marriage, or children? State legislatures, and certainly the Maryland legislature, regulates all of these aspects of daily life. And it might sound simply like a scheme aimed at kind of social control, and it is to an important degree, but former slaves learn over time that what black laws are really aiming at is making life for them so untenable that they will self-deport. It is another, if you will, prong of the colonization way of thinking. How do you persuade people to leave? Well, you make their lives so impossible. You create circumstances under which they can't thrive as individuals or as families or as a community, and they will choose to migrate to Canada or to Haiti or to West Africa. So black laws are an important part of this story because they are not just ways of regulating everyday life. They are really a wholesale scheme that aim to, in essence, persuade people to deport themselves.
Right. You know, and I think that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that that ties in with, in a sense, what's happening today. And, you know, I can't remember which presidential candidate mentioned actually said the word self-deport, you know, creating conditions in the U.S. where people would want to self-deport. And also what's happening right now at the border, there isn't a direct correlation here or comparison here, but, you know, trying to make entry and asylum seeking in the U.S. so difficult and so painful that people won't want to come. Right.
I think that is a really useful and apt analogy, that sometimes policy is made in Congress or driven by high court decisions. But part of what the study for me of this early history made plain is that actually these grand, right, big questions, who is a citizen, who belongs, who's in, who's out, play out most vividly very close to the ground, play out in the hands of, you know, relatively minor functionaries who are regulating day-to-day life. So a community can be terrorized even without the authorization or the concerted thinking of Congress or the sanctioning of a high court, if local officials are willing, in my example, to selectively but pointedly use black laws to harass people, right, and to make their lives untenable. And so here in the 21st century, what we have is the selective, uneven, but pointed exercise of discretion on the part of low-level officials in communities who are creating a circumstance of terror that ripples through a community and may lead people to make decisions about where they live, how they organize their families and their communities, may even lead them to, you know, quote unquote, self-deport. That is part of the strategy, right here. That is not an accident. That is not the inefficiency of the state. That is one of the state's principal longstanding instruments. And former slaves knew that well. There might be a rule that says, you know, you can't travel. It only got enforced some of the time. But that didn't mean that everyone who aspired to travel wasn't cognizant of how risky that was, didn't feel the strain when they needed to travel for work, to be with family, or the like. This is an old strategy, one that former slaves knew well through Black laws. And I take your point that today we seem to be witnessing that, even as neither Congress nor the Supreme Court, nor even the president, frankly, have engaged in some thoroughgoing, thoughtful, and evenly applied set of new rules or regulations around immigration.
So, you know, moving back to today, I know that the administration has been moving in this direction of, you know, making the country as homogenous as possible. And one of the proposals, I think it happened last year, was around changing the language around birthright citizenship. What was that proposal? And, you know, I think most of us have actually forgotten that that actually happened.
Well, so much has happened. It can be difficult to keep track, but I'm happy to remind your listeners that going back as far as 2015, candidate Trump included among his promises, it was a vague promise, but clearly one in which he proposed to do away with birthright citizenship. And what he meant by that, I think, is still not clear. But yes, in the end of October of 2018, he gave an interview during which he revealed that he believed he had the power to somehow do away with birthright citizenship, or at least curtail it by way of executive order. He has not done that. At least he has not yet done that. So the president, his proposals are vague, and there are major questions about the degree to which a president can use an executive order to change the terms of the Constitution. What can I say? Stay tuned. However, it's important to point out that it's not only the president. Every year since 2009, Congress has had in committee what's called the Birthright Citizenship Act. And that act proposes to not eliminate birthright citizenship, which is provided for in the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. It proposes to interpret some murky language not easily understood language in the 14th Amendment, which excludes from birthright citizenship people who are not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Wow, what does that mean? Well, in 1868, what it principally meant was that Congress created exceptions to the birthright citizenship provision of the amendment for whom the children of foreign diplomats who were born in the U.S. just incidentally, are not birthright citizens. Were there to be a standing army, foreign army occupying the U.S., the children born to members of an occupying army would not be citizens by virtue of birthright. The third exception was Native Americans, because in the 1860s, Native nations continued to enjoy sovereignty, not only over their territory, but over their people. The 14th Amendment does not reach into Native nations and transform people subject to Native sovereignty to U.S. sovereignty. Well, subsequent to 1868, there is a debate about the degree to which the children of immigrants enjoy birthright citizenship. In 1898, the Supreme Court says, for example, that yes, the children of Chinese immigrants, even if the child's parents are not eligible to be citizens, the child is a citizen in a case called Wong Kim Ark. That's a long windup to say what Congress is proposing in the Birthright Citizenship Act is to reinterpret that language to make clear that the children of unauthorized immigrants are people not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and hence not entitled to birthright citizenship. And they propose that going forward, which is to say it wouldn't change retroactively anyone's citizenship status, but it would affect or proposes to affect the citizenship status of people going forward.
Yeah, when you reminded me that it was just in October, which was, what, 6 months ago? I mean, it felt like it was, years ago.
Yeah, well, there is that. But but I'm here, right? Follow me on Twitter, because even when the rest of the country is understandably has turned its attention elsewhere, this is a question and a debate that I'm trying to follow very carefully and to help listeners and readers and followers stay abreast of, so that when new episodes on this question of birthright citizenship come up, and try to help people sort of stay current on where that debate stands.
Well, we will definitely follow you on Twitter. I was going to close by asking you, how do we, once we get some balance back and some sanity back, how do we shore up legally birthright citizenship? But then I realize, it doesn't matter necessarily, because we wouldn't be having this conversation had we had a different administration, first of all. And then the hands of the wrong person in the hands of the wrong administration, anything can be interpreted in bad faith.
I think that's right. But I would just say it's important when I mention, for example, the Birthright Citizenship Act in Congress, the first introduction of that bill is 2009. It is well before the Trump administration takes over, which is to say that I'm here to be vigilant on this question, because I'm not convinced that simply with a change in administration, this debate disappears. It is a debate that has had consequences in Europe, for example. It has had consequences in Canada. It has had consequences in the UK. So it is perhaps not the frontline question of the day, but it is one to keep an eye on, because it predates the Trump administration. It has implications elsewhere in the West, and I'm not sure where the debate ends, frankly. So, so follow me, and I'll be happy to at least keep you apprised of, I'm sorry to say, one more, grave humanitarian crisis amidst many that characterize our own time.
And on that note, thank you so much, Martha S. Jones, for joining me. This was a really, really important conversation to have.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode of The Electorate, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast. And please visit The Electorate on social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and that's @Electorate. And until next time, keep up the good fight.